Ever wonder why some traits seem to, you know, follow your family line perfectly, while others just pop up unexpectedly, skipping generations, or maybe only showing up in certain family members? It's all part of this incredibly intricate choreography happening right down at the cellular level. Today, we're doing a deep dive into that microscopic world of genetics. We're moving beyond just the genes themselves to their incredible vehicles, the chromosomes. This deep dive is built on a really fantastic series of lectures from Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman. He really helps us visualize this complex, almost elegant dance of inheritance.
Yeah, what's truly fascinating in Dr. Hoffman's lectures is how he takes genetic phenomena we might think we know, and then he peels back the layers to show the actual chromosomal mechanics underneath. It's like a powerful shortcut to being genuinely well-informed about the blueprint of life. It shows you why things happen the way they do.
Exactly. So our mission here is to take Dr. Hoffman's insights and really help you graft the foundational rules of inheritance, you know, from Mendel's laws to some pretty startling exceptions, and even how our genetic code can be edited, sometimes intentionally, sometimes by accident, at that chromosomal level. Okay, so let's start where Dr. Hoffman often does, revisiting those classic genetic crosses, like tracking yellow round seeds versus green wrinkled ones in peas. For a long time, we sort of thought about genes as these isolated units, but Dr. Hoffman makes this really crucial point. Genes aren't lone entities. They're like passengers on a big boat, right? And that boat is the chromosome.
Absolutely. Dr. Hoffman really emphasizes that it's the chromosomes themselves that assort during inheritance, not the individual genes floating around. And every gene has its specific address on that chromosome boat, which we call a locus. And once you start seeing genes as part of these bigger chromosome structures, Mendel's laws, which can seem a bit abstract, they suddenly become brilliantly concrete. You can picture them.
That makes so much more sense. Like, okay, take Mendel's law of segregation. Dr. Hoffman clarifies, it's not just some theoretical idea about allele separating. It physically happens when the homologous chromosomes, those pairs carrying the different alleles for the same gene, they literally get pulled apart during anaphase out of meiosis. It's a very tangible event.
Right. And then there's the law of independent assortment. Dr. Hoffman connects this beautifully to genes that are on different chromosomes, so different boats, using his analogy. They assort independently because how those homologous pairs line up in metaphase I of meiosis is completely random. One pair lines up this way, another pair lines up that way independently. It's like a whole series of coin flips.
Yeah.
And that randomness leads to incredible genetic diversity in the gametes.
Okay. And the result of all this, this precise yet beautifully random chromosomal shuffling, is the stunning variety we see in offspring.
Yeah.
Right? It explains how you get all these diverse gametes, which then leads to those familiar 9.3.3.1 ratios you see in dihybrid crosses.
Yeah.
You get the parental types back, like the original yellow round or green wrinkled.
Mm-hmm.
But you also get these exciting new recombinant types, like yellow and wrinkled or green and round, all thanks to that chromosomal dance.
Now, Dr. Hoffman introduces another key distinction. Autosomes versus sex chromosomes. Most of our chromosomes are autosomes. They carry the vast majority of our, you know, self traits. But then you have the sex chromosomes. They don't just determine biological sex. They carry other critical genes too. Dr. Hoffman often uses that classic fruit fly eye color example, red versus white eyes, to show their unique inheritance patterns.
Yeah. And what makes the sex chromosomes so different, why we treat them separately, is that they often aren't truly homologous. Think about humans or fruit flies. The X and Y chromosomes are really different sizes. The Y chromosome is much smaller, and it's actually missing a lot of the genes that are present on the X. And this structural difference, it has huge implications for inheritance.
Right. And this is where it gets particularly interesting for males, isn't it? Because males are XY. They only have that one X chromosome. So that means they only have a single allele for any gene that's on the X chromosome. Dr. Hoffman calls this hemizygosity. Homozygous, yeah.
There's no second allele on a matching chromosome to, like, mask a recessive one.
Yeah.
So whatever allele a male has on a single X chromosome, that's the trait he expresses. There are no dominance games for those X-linked traits in males.
You see this so clearly in those fruit fly icar crosses Dr. Hoffman describes. The first generation, the F1, might look like simple Mendelian inheritance at first glance. But then you look at the F2 generation and boom, you see these sex-specific ratios. For example, maybe all the F2 females have red eyes. But among the F2 males, it's a 50-50 split, half red, half white eyes. That outcome really shows how sex-linked inheritance is fundamentally different from autosomal patterns.
And speaking of sex determination, Dr. Hoffman points out the XY system isn't the only way nature does it. He talks about other fascinating systems like the XZ system in grasshoppers. Males just have one XN. That's it. No second sex chromosome.
Mm.
Or the ZW system in birds, which is like a total flip. It's the female who determines the offspring's sex, not the male like in us mammals.
Right. Which raises an important question. How many ways can this work? Dr. Hoffman also highlights the really wild haplodiploid system in bees. No sex chromosomes involved at all there. Females are diploid, they develop from fertilized eggs. But males are haploid, they develop from unfertilized eggs.
Wow.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, you get these mind-bending family trees Dr. Hoffman describes. A male bee has no father and he can't have sons. But he does have a grandfather and he can have grandsons.
That's bizarre.
It's pretty wild, right? It's just a vivid reminder that nature finds so many different ingenious paths to get to similar biological outcomes, each with its own incredible quirks. And this uniqueness, especially homozygosity in X, Y, or XD systems, helps explain why certain heritable disorders often affect males more. Females can often be carriers without showing the trait themselves.
Okay, so this brings up a bit of a puzzle that Dr. Hoffman discusses. If females have two X chromosomes and males only have one, how do cells handle that potential imbalance? Wouldn't females make, like, twice as much protein from all those X-linked genes? Wouldn't that mess things up?
That's exactly the dosage difference problem, and it's a serious issue. Organisms absolutely need ways to compensate for that dosage difference. They need mechanisms for dosage compensation. Without it, yeah, that disparity in gene products could really disrupt cell function and development.
And the way mammals solve this is just ingenious, as Dr. Hoffman explains it. X chromosome inactivation. In females, one of the two X chromosomes gets randomly turned off, basically supercoiled, packed away so tightly it becomes unreadable. This happens during early embryonic development.
Right, not right at fertilization.
Yeah, Dr. Hoffman points out it happens a bit later, when the embryo is already multicellular. And this is key because the inactivation is random. Different cells shut down different X chromosomes. One cell might silence the maternal X, the cell next door might silence the paternal X.
And this random inactivation is what leads to genetic mosaics in females who are heterozygous for X-linked traits. It means different patches of their body are actually expressing different alleles. The classic example, the one everyone knows, is the calico cat.
Right, the patches of orange and black fur.
Exactly. They're almost always female because you need two X chromosomes, one carrying the orange allele, one carrying the black allele, to get those distinct patches through random inactivation. Males only have one X, so they just can't be calico. Huh. And Dr. Hoffman gives a human example, too. A woman might have patches of skin that sweat easily right next to patches that don't, all because different X chromosomes were inactivated in those different cell lineages.
So what does this really mean for us? It means even inside a single individual, there can be this amazing genetic diversity playing out, like, right on the surface. Mm-hmm. It's a testament to these elegant solutions nature comes up with for really complex biological problems.
Okay, so we've been talking about linked genes, the ones on the same chromosome, as if they should always travel together. Like, you know, passengers who never leave their boat.
Mm-hmm.
But then Dr. Hoffman presents this really compelling fruit fly example, looking at body color and wing shape. And the inheritance patterns just don't fit simple linkage. How on earth can you get recombinant offspring if the genes are supposed to be stuck together on the same chromosome? Ah, okay. This brings us to the absolutely critical role of crossing over. It's also called recombination between homologous chromosomes, and it happens during meiosis. What's fascinating here is how crossing over, which is a totally normal and essential part of meiosis, can effectively unlink genes. It does this by swapping segments between the non-sister chromatids of homologous chromosomes.
No.
So if a crossover event happens physically between the loci of two linked genes, those two genes can actually end up in different gametes. It breaks the linkage.
Okay.
It's the exception to the rule that all passengers stay together, and it's a massively important source of genetic variation.
And this crossing over thing, it wasn't just some biological curiosity. It became a powerful tool, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hoffman reveals how, like, way before you could even think about sequencing DNA, some clever grad student figured out that just by looking at the proportion of recombinant offspring, you could calculate the recombination frequency and actually map where genes were located on a chromosome.
Exactly. The underlying idea is so elegant. The lower the recombination frequency between two genes, the closer they must be physically located on that chromosome.
Why?
Well, simply because there's less physical space between them for a random crossover event to occur.
Oh, okay. Makes sense.
Genes that are far apart have lots of room between them, so crossovers happen more frequently, leading to a higher recombination frequency. This brilliant insight allowed scientists to build detailed gene maps based purely on looking at inheritance patterns across generations. It was a total game changer for genetics.
So up to now, we've mostly talked about changes at the single gene level or recombination. But Dr. Hoffman then takes us into a much larger scale of alteration. Chromosomal mutations, these are big changes.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, Dr. Hoffman explains that these mutations affect huge regions of DNA. We're talking hundreds, maybe thousands of genes sometimes. And even if the genes themselves aren't damaged, just moving them to a new location on a chromosome or changing the structure around them can totally mess up their regulation, you know, turning them on when they should be off or vice versa.
Right. And Dr. Hoffman breaks these down into several main types. First, deletion. That sounds straightforward, just losing a chunk of chromosome and all the genes in that chunk.
Exactly. The consequences can be pretty severe, depending on what genes are lost.
Okay. Then there's duplication. A segment gets copied.
Right. Often inserted right next to the original segment. But here's where Dr. Hoffman makes a surprising point. Duplication isn't always bad. Sometimes it can actually be beneficial.
How so?
Well, it provides extra copies of genes. Natural selection can then sort of experiment with these extra copies over evolutionary time. One copy can keep doing the essential original job, while the duplicated copy is free to mutate and potentially gain a new function without harming the organism. It's like nature's genetic R&D department, fostering innovation.
That's a really powerful idea. Okay, next is inversion. A segment gets flipped around.
Yep, reversed end to end. Nothing's lost or gained in terms of genetic material. But, as Dr. Hoffman explains, just flipping that segment can really disrupt gene regulation. Imagine regulatory sequences ending up in the wrong place relative to the gene they control. It could make a gene that needs careful control suddenly become constitutive, basically, always switched on. That could be very problematic.
Okay. And finally, reciprocal translocation. That sounds complicated.
It is a bit more complex. This involves two non-homologous chromosomes, so completely different chromosome type swapping segments. These aren't the normal homologous exchanges like in crossing over. These are breaks and reattachments between different chromosome pairs. Dr. Hoffman mentions the Philadelphia chromosome as a well-known human example. It's a specific translocation, often linked to certain types of leukemia. While not always lethal to the cell initially, it profoundly messes up normal cellular function because genes suddenly find themselves in a totally foreign regulatory neighborhood.
Okay, so we've covered direct DNA sequence changes, we've covered these big chromosomal rearrangements, but then Dr. Hoffman takes us into this other realm, almost above genetics. He calls it epigenetics. This affects how traits are inherited without actually changing the underlying A's, T's, C's, and G's. It's like notes written in the margin of the genetic book.
That's a great analogy. Exactly. Epigenetics refers to these heritable changes in how genes are expressed or used. But these changes happen without altering the fundamental DNA sequence itself. The genes are perfectly intact, the sequence is unchanged, but their activity, whether they're turned on or off, is modified.
In a prime example, Dr. Hoffman talks about genetic imprinting. This often involves something called methylation, right? Adding chemical tags, methyl groups to the DNA.
Precisely. Think of it like sticking little chemical off switches onto the DNA. Sticking these methyl groups onto a gene, or near it, can effectively silence it, make it unreadable by the cell's machinery. Even though the gene sequence itself, the book, as you said, is perfectly fine.
Okay, and the really crucial part about imprinting is, it's not random like X inactivation, is it?
No, not at all. It creates what's called a parent of origin effect. Whether a specific gene is methylated and silenced depends entirely on which parent you inherited that allele from. The gene's activity is literally marked or imprinted based on its parental lineage, whether it came through the egg or the sperm.
Wow. Dr. Hoffman uses this really striking example of the dwarf mouse to illustrate this. You can have a mouse that's heterozygous. It's got one normal allele and one recessive allele for dwarfism.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, you'd expect the normal allele to be dominant, right? So the mouse should be normal size.
Typically, yes.
But if the normal dominant allele came from the mother, and for this particular gene, the mother's alleles are always imprinted, methylated, and silenced, then it's like that normal allele isn't even there. It's silenced.
Exactly.
So the mouse ends up expressing the recessive dwarf trait from the father's allele, even though genetically it has a dominant normal allele.
Right. So what does this all mean for how we think about inheritance? Dr. Hoffman shows us that even with regular autosomal genes, genes not on the sex chromosomes, imprinting can create an effect that looks an awful lot like sex-linked inheritance, where only one allele is effectively active. But the underlying reason is totally different. It's not about the sex chromosome it's on. It's about which parent it came from.
That's fascinating.
It's just another powerful reminder of how many layers of regulation control our genes, going way beyond just the DNA sequence itself.
Wow. What an incredible deep dive that was. I mean, from visualizing that intricate dance of chromosomes during meiosis to really understanding the unique challenges posed by sex-linked genes and nature's brilliant fixes like X inactivation, and then peeling back yet another layer to see how genes get mapped using recombination and how they're regulated even beyond their sequence through epigenetics. Dr. Hoffman's lectures really do illustrate the just stunning complexity, but also the elegance of how inheritance works.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we connect all this to the bigger picture, thinking about Dr. Hoffman's insights, knowing how intricately regulated our genetic blueprint is, and yet how vulnerable it can be to both these large-scale chromosomal changes and those subtle epigenetic marks, it really raises an important question, doesn't it? Like, what new frontiers do you think this ever-deepening understanding of genetics is going to unlock, you know, in medicine, in agriculture, maybe even in how we understand evolution itself?
It's truly incredible stuff to think about, whether you're looking at your own family tree or maybe the diversity in a litter of puppies or just the vast tapestry of species out there. This knowledge really does profoundly transform how you see not just individual traits, but the whole incredible evolving story of life on Earth.